You are listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast, focusing on the changing nature of retirement today and the non-financial aspects of a successful retirement transition. Join host Joe Casey and learn from leading experts in the field and the stories of people who created interesting second acts as they share practical ideas and tips to create your own. Check out our website at retirementwisdom.com, where you can download our newsletter and other resources to learn more about how coaching can help you. The best way to support this podcast is to head over to Apple Podcasts and post a rating and a comment. It's easy and it's free. Join our conversations and get wiser about your retirement.
Welcome to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. Have you ever noticed friends, family members doing things that you resolve never to do, especially when you get old? Well, our guest today started keeping a list of these things, and over time, began to see them differently. Our guest is Stephen Petro. He's an award-winning journalist and book author who is best known for his Washington Post and New York Times essays on aging, health, and civility. He's also an opinion columnist for USA Today, where he writes about civil discourse and manners. Stephen's 2019 TED Talk, Three Ways to Practice Civility, has been viewed more than 1.8 million times and translated into 13 languages. He's the author of 6 books, including Stephen Petro's Complete Gay and Lesbian Manners, and his new book, which we'll be discussing today, Stupid Things I Won't Do When I'm Old. In addition to his writing, you may hear Stephen on NPR's All Things Considered Weekend, or one of your favorite or least favorite TV networks. Stephen also served as the host and executive producer of The Civilist, a podcast from Public Radio International and North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Joe, it's a pleasure.
So I really loved your book, and I read that your book really began with a list. Tell us the story of the list.
Well, yes, it began with a list, and this list was generated, started about 10 years ago, and I was in my early 50s then. My parents were in their mid-70s, and I saw that they were kind of moving into this new chapter, this new stage of being older. They were kind of making mistakes in my mind, and I'm the eldest of three, and I was always the smart ass and the journalist, so I started keeping this list of things I thought that they could do better that would protect them and make my life easier as one of their kids. And this list kind of went on and on. I said, 30 items, 50 items, and 100 items. And I wound up writing a New York Times column called Things I Will Do Differently When I Get Old. And it was basically a pledge to myself about how I could age smarter and better than my parents. And it didn't have necessarily the snarky tone that the book title has, which we can come back to. But that really seemed to strike a nerve among readers. It was among the most read for 2 weeks. And then people started sending me their own lists, and I didn't realize people were keeping lists themselves. And I got about 200 lists, and I thought, gee, something's happening here. I think there's a book. And so it became the book, and you know, it's been enjoying quite a bit of activity these past months. So it's been good.
So about the snarky title,
there
are some people who might see it as ageist and react, that's ageist, call you out on that. But I really think, I hope people read it, because it's really about how to make smarter choices and avoid self-defeating behaviors.
Exactly, exactly. And some people have reacted negatively to the title, but one of the things I'm trying to do in the book is bring a sense of humor to, you know, topics that are generally, you know, not considered funny. So, you know, we're talking about, you know, getting old or possibly disability, sickness, death and dying, you know, not your like ha-ha topics unless you're talking to a lesbian comedian, which I was a couple of weeks ago, and that's a different story. So, you know, the title is meant to be in that vein also, and to say, it's okay to talk about these things, and here's one way in, and humor is one way in.
That's a great way in. So how do you look at the things on the list now compared to when you started it 10 years ago?
Well, the biggest revelation for me was, so I was compiling the list, and then I wrote the article, and then I wrote the book. And I kept adding to the list. And about a year and a half, 2 years ago, I realized when I was 62, oh, you know what, Stephen? It's time to start implementing that list, because that is really the crucial part of aging better and aging smarter is to start to make those decisions, make those choices, implement them. And that was, you know, that was kind of like a little bit of a mind bend, because that sort of put me squarely in the bullseye of my audience too. And the point of the book is, you know, small changes can lead to lasting ones and important ones. So, you know, I'm sitting here in my office talking to you, and I remember I was trying to get a book off the top bookshelf. And like I've done for decades, I got up with one foot on my desk and one foot on a chair, and I didn't have shoes on, and I still couldn't reach the book. So I was kind of hopping up a little bit, and I stopped myself and I said, this is one of those stupid things. So I got down, put on some shoes, and I got the stepladder. And I went through this whole thing in my head because it kind of constrained my behavior. But the point was, it was also meant to make sure that I didn't have an injury that would further limit my world or limit my world. And so that's the theme of the book. You know, we have to make some decisions that seem to be constricting, but they're really intended to keep us connected or keep us involved and so on.
I wrote down a quote from your book, many quotes, but one in a place where I could always see it, which is from that story. This is not a good idea anymore.
Yes. There are many ideas that were good for a long time, and you know, and they're not anymore. And then, of course, there are new ideas that come into vogue. And you know, one of the new ideas that I talk about is this notion of being a perennial. So we're very divided by our generation. We have the greatest generation. We have the boomers, millennials, Gen X, Y, and Z. And in a way, those are divisions that keep us apart. And so I like this notion of being a perennial. And anybody can be a perennial, whether you're 25 or 64 like we are, or 85. It's an attitude, and it's an attitude of being involved and curious, engaged, often having friends of different generations. So this is like a new behavior that we can start to adopt that is very gratifying. I've had the experience several times, especially with multi-generation friends, but also having younger folks really kind of keep me in the swim of what's happening in life. And I think that's important to all of us.
I love that. Be a perennial. Makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. So what flower, what perennial flower would you be?
Oh boy, I'm going to need time to think about that one. But
okay.
How about yourself? What do you have in mind?
I'm just looking out into my garden right now. I'm happy to be an hydrangea.
Yeah. I'm thinking of one that I recently saw, didn't notice it for what must have been weeks near my office. And we used to have one in our first house. And so I don't recall the name of it, but that's the one I have in mind, but I'll research it. It's a great question.
Okay.
So I noticed that Jane Brody recently wrote a piece in the Times about how your book inspired her to step back a little bit, take stock of ways in which she needed to adapt, and we'll include a link to that in the show notes. Mm-hmm. What are some of the ways that you think, or some of the areas you think people should look at where we might need to make some adjustments?
Well, the book is divided into three sections, and first part is stupid things I won't do today. Those are things that might be more actionable now. Stupid things I won't do tomorrow, future planning. And then stupid things I won't do at the end, which is really sort of for the final chapters of life. And yeah, so in that first part, I talk about not limiting myself to friends my own age, which I've talked a little bit about. I also talk about not joining what's called the organ recital. And for those who are not familiar with that phrase, it is when a group of 50 plus people get together and start talking about all their aches and pains, sciatica, migraines, this and that. And that becomes kind of the defining element of the conversation. And then that becomes almost a defining element of who we are. So I don't know about you, Jeb, but like when I was younger, I talked an awful lot about my work, about my vacation, about my family. And now we're talking about our health or lack thereof. And the point there is, it's fine to talk somewhat about it, but don't let it become this dominating factor, because that then impacts you and how people see you. They see you as an illness rather than, you know, as a person. I talk about not lying about your age, especially on dating apps. But it, you know, in general, some of us have had difficulty coming to terms with the number. And I don't know how you felt when you turned 60 or 64. I had more problems with 60. By the time I got to 64, I was like, okay, I am now I'm now a sexagenarian. You know, my favorite word that has absolutely nothing to do with sex, but has the word sex in it.
Yes.
But I'd been recently divorced, and I was on some of these apps, and I was lying about my age, and it got complicated. And then I felt bad about myself because I really am a certain age. And so that is about accepting who we are and being authentic about who we are. I think that, you know, leads to greater happiness. And part of the research that I did was that when we think, or when we associate being older with negatives, we actually are less healthy, we have more mental health issues, and we live less long. So we do want to recalibrate what we, how we understand what it means to be older. So many of the chapters in this book are kind of tweaks on how we can do that, how we can feel better about ourselves. And I know I'm rambling here a little bit, but it's like I have this birthday card that I've been keeping on my desk because it really irritated me, even though some great friends gave it to me. And there are two cows on the cover. And it says, "Did you know that as you get older, your hearing and eyesight begin to fail?" So it's a funny looking card. You know, there's a little bit of a ha-ha in that. But then there's a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, because failing hearing and eyesight are correlated with aging, but those are, you know, those are actually conditions, and that's different. But then you open the card and it's in the tiniest print, which I can hardly read. "So what do you think of your musical birthday card?" And of course, there's no music coming out of it, so it's meant to imply that I'm now deaf. This is the kind of humor that goes both ways. There's a little bit of a zing in it and a negativity in it that I don't like, but I think that is very current in how we all talk, and we don't realize that ageism is on the same level or close to the same level as many of the other isms in our world these days.
It's a serious problem because it's one of the last that seems to be still acceptable.
Yes, it does seem to be acceptable because there's so many birthday and other cards like this and jokes, and we don't know how to use a laptop or a Kindle or this or that, and some of us don't. And I do make the point, it's important to stay up to date with some technology, because the point of these technologies is to keep us connected with those we care about. And then if we don't, we become isolated, and that has harmful effects.
I really love the "I won't join the organ recital." And just a quick comment on that. The only other group besides us older adults with this topic is runners. I'm a former broken down injured runner. And I used to turn my smartphone audio up before races because you're standing there waiting for the race to begin. And you have thousands of runners all complaining about their injuries at the same time. So never ask a runner.
That probably seems to me like a way to psych each other out. I don't know.
Yeah, could be. But we can all relate to them. But in observing your parents, what were the consequences you saw of them not adapting in some ways?
You know, the thing I saw most, especially I'll say with my dad, and I think this is somewhat of a male condition. He was very independent, very stubborn. He always liked to do things his way. And he really did not want assistance in general. And he did not want his three kids to be providing any kind of really help, I'll say in air quotes. And we were very aware of the sort of family dynamic and the generational dynamic and did not want to be telling our father what to do, both because we knew that that was futile, and that's really not how we were approaching, you know, these problems, especially where he was falling a lot. So we tried to give him tools, and he rejected most of them, and then he continued to fall, and he died. He died from a series of falls. And what really struck me was his own father had died from a series of falls, and my dad had been trying to help his dad not do that. So in a way, I feel like I have a greater awareness of these issues, and I'm hoping that by having written them down and made a pledge, I will do better, and, you know, that I will use that walker when I need the walker, or I will install the grab bar in the shower when I need it. But I also worry that, you know, I have this inherited stubbornness, you know, in me that may get in the way when the time comes. We'll see about that. But what really happened was my dad's world got smaller by many of the decisions that he made, and we were trying to help him keep an open and involved world, which mattered so much to him. And that was painful.
And he was a former professor and journalist.
Yes. The Intrepid had traveled all over, and, you know, he couldn't walk by himself in the end. And that was, you know, that was very confining for him. And I felt a great deal of empathy. I can't imagine what that would be like.
If you notice that Apple just came out in the most recent iOS update with an app about falling, walking stabilization app, something to look at, picking up on your point about technology before.
I wasn't aware of that. I will check that out. That's good to know.
there's an article in the Wall Street Journal last week and got my attention, and because it's falling such a big problem.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's so risky, high stakes there. You mentioned the stubbornness, and there's always a fine line between good habits, routines that we fall into, and just keeping with them. I thought of this morning when I was walking in this park right near our house, because I noticed I was walking in exactly the same direction as I have the last 4.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about your resolution about I won't refuse to change my ways.
Yes. This came to me as I realized I was guilty of being in various ruts. And this is before the pandemic, but I had gone to a yoga class that I regularly went to in a studio. And the teacher, Amy, decided that she was going to start to change things up for us, because we would come in and we would put our mats down in the exact same places, and we would face her in the exact same place. And it was all very sort of preordained. And so I came in one day and she's sitting in a different part of the room, and she's asking us not to sit next to the people that we usually sat with. So it was awkward. It was unfamiliar. It meant looking in a different direction. It meant being in the shadow of different people. And then she did a very different practice that didn't follow the usual order. And I was resisting, and I was kind of in quietly, in a yoga way, very cantankerous in my mind about it. But her point was, we need to be more comfortable making adaptations, getting out of the ruts that we know, because they become so familiar and they too become confining. And so I remember I was home after that a couple of days later, and I had a Jack Russell Terrier then, and we would always go out of the house and walk right. And then we had this loop that we would take. And I knew it, and I could do it without really paying attention to anything. So I decided I was going to go left. And not only did I have to pay attention because there were sort of breaks in the sidewalk and the streets came in different places, but I saw different people in the morning. I saw different flower beds, trees, houses. And it was like, oh, this is actually kind of cool to change my perspective just by making a left turn to start rather than a right turn. And so that's a metaphor also for how we live on a daily basis. How can we bring in some changes that will open our worlds up a little bit more rather than close them down?
You'll know from listening to this podcast that, like many of you, I'm a card-carrying, lifelong learner. And that's why I'm thrilled today to bring this offer from One Day University to our listeners. You know, every college has that one professor whose class was so popular that students lined up to get a spot before they graduate. Well, One Day University brings over 200 of these top-rated professors together online to present incredible live stream talks based on their most popular courses. And the professors are selected from schools across the country, including Yale, Stanford, Harvard, UCLA, Duke, Michigan, Columbia, and many more. Every weekday, One Day University offers a new one-hour live stream talk, followed by a live Q&A with the professor. So you can learn something new every day about history, politics, art, science, music, psychology, and much more. And best of all, there's no homework or tests, just the joy of learning new things from incredible professors. Memberships are just $8.95 a month, or $89 a year, but you can try 2 weeks for free. Plus, if you visit onedayu.com/wisdom and sign up for an annual plan, you can get your first year for half price. Here are some talks that I found interesting. First, The Art of Aging by Katherine Sanderson at Amherst College. Next, Books That Changed the World by Joseph Luzzi at Bard College. And then Four Films That Changed America by Mark Lapidula at Yale. I'll include a link in the show notes to the video library so you can browse it for yourself and see what jumps out to you. So learn more and start your 2-week free trial at onedayu.com/wisdom. That's www.onedayu.com/wisdom. And you'll find that link in the show notes.
Another thing that I'm already guilty of, it's already a challenge for me, is any family members who might be listening to this podcast can attest, and some of our listeners to this podcast can attest, and that's I won't tell the story more than 100 times.
So what's your favorite story, Joe?
Well, one of them is I was at a football game in Mexico City a couple years ago with our oldest daughter. A friend of mine was supposed to go. couldn't go. So she said, I'm not going to pass up on that. You have to go. And all of a sudden we were at lunch and there was the most interesting man, the guy, the actor, Jonathan Goldsmith from the Dos Equis commercials, sitting right next to us. So I said, I have to strike up a conversation. I just read an article about him. So we ended up running into the Patriots in the locker in the elevator. And they ended up, we were staying in the penthouse for some reason. They just put us on the top floor. So the Patriots said to my daughter, you got to tell me who your dad is, because there's no way he's got to be somebody staying in the penthouse. She said, no, it's just my dad. So next day, we're coming down the elevator. Some of the same Patriots players get on. They say, how you doing, et cetera. She said, I still want to know who your dad is. So then the most interesting man in the world walks on to the elevator, starts up a conversation with us, how was your dinner last night, et cetera, et cetera. He leaves, and the other said, okay, now you got to tell me who your dad is. So it's just my dad. So it's a rambling story, but I've told it more than once.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting about that chapter, because that is the chapter where I feel like my own perspective on all of these topics started to shift. And the first part of that chapter is kind of a little bit of a finger wagging to myself, to you, and to everyone. Don't tell the same story over and over. You're boring people. And families and networks come up with ways to, you know, to indicate you've done this before and we don't want to hear it again. But, you know, the more I kind of, this was especially as I saw my dad, he had a story that he loved to tell. And it was when he was in his 30s, he went as a journalist on a USS Coast Guard cutter across the top of Russia, as it was called then. And they had encounters with the Russians and sort of a Cold War story, but there were polar bears. And he came home and he told the kids this story. And then he told that story for decades after. And it would shift over time, you know, fairly significantly. But in a way, it never became boring. In a way, the shifts became interesting because they told me that he was now emphasizing different parts of the story as he got older. And the Russians kind of faded from the story and the polar bears got larger. And so it was like man versus nature. And I came to realize that also these stories, you know, come to define us. And as we're getting older or as we become old, we want people to remember the guy who was like wrestling with polar bears in the Arctic rather than the guy who's stumbling and falling. And so, you know, I think these stories matter. They matter for legacy and they matter for how we feel about ourselves and who we were, because we still are that person, even if we can't wrestle with polar bears, so to speak.
That's a great story. So the other one that got my attention, given your background and some of the other writing you've done, I Won't Forget My Manners. So tell us about etiquette and manners as we age.
So for folks who are listening to this, I am known, probably primarily known for writing about manners and civility. I write for USA Today on those things, and I've written a number of books on that topic. And I did a TED Talk, Three Ways to Practice Civility. So this is something that matters to me. And it's not so much that I care about place settings or how Joseph Casey, with whatever your middle name is, how you would monogram your shirts. What's your middle initial?
E.
But it's about how we treat each other. It's about listening and it's about respect. And, you know, but many people, when they get older, they may be suffering from an actual condition like dementia or Alzheimer's, and their behaviors may change. We also need to have moments of grace for folks who are challenged or who are suffering that way and not hold them necessarily to the same standard. And I remember seeing, you know, my mother, who was always so proper at the table, when she had dementia, sometimes she used her hands to eat. There was like Stephen, the etiquette expert, you know, I'm like appalled. And then there's Stephen, the son and the human being, saying, Mom, I love you and I understand this is just where you are now. And I need to step in and be with you in that. I often have told in the past how when Jacqueline Kennedy was first lady and then there was a state dinner and the king of somewhere or other dunked his hands into the soup thinking they were a water bowl. And to make him comfortable and let everyone know that it was okay, Mrs. Kennedy apparently dunked her hands into the soup as well. I did not start eating with my hands with my mom, but I did have no judgment about that. And so it's a time when we could use fewer judgments.
Absolutely. I have a quick story. When our eldest daughter was in first grade, she learned to play the flute. So after Thanksgiving dinner, she wanted to have a recital for all the family members. So we did, played great, everyone clapped. It got very quiet. And then her great aunt, who had dementia at the time, mm-hmm. later Alzheimer's as well, just said as loud as could be, pitiful.
Excuse me. But, you know, I think I'm not going to say anything more there, is that we lose our filters at a certain point, but
yeah, yes.
But she also may have been thinking about some other recital, I'm sure.
Yeah, yes, absolutely, no doubt. So we have to make sure we constantly adjust. So the other thing you talk about in addition to following is balance in a different context, making sure that you have balance in your life going forward. Curious about your thoughts on that one.
Yeah. So, the little bit I know about you, you made a big, career switch probably not that long ago, if I understand correctly.
12 years, but it's flying by.
I'm assuming there was some balance question or work-life balance in that decision for you. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. And, we grow up and we work hard, and much of the way people are valued in this society is on, what's your job title? How much do you make? What does your house look like? Sort of these very tangible things. And I often refer to them as resume values. And I've seen this shift in myself, and I've seen the shift in some others. And I think you're an example too, where you kind of move from resume values to, really like this phrase, but eulogy virtues. And those are the kinds of things you would hope that people might say about you when you die. Mm-hmm. I don't really want someone to say when I died, oh, well, he was the senior vice president at this or that, or he had a 3 or 4 bedroom house. I'm hoping people will say he was kind, he was generous, he liked his friends, he was good to his friends, his family, so on and so forth, whatever those things are. And I think this is kind of the shift in balance that I'm talking about here that becomes more important. And it becomes also important for another reason. Because as we get older, we're not in the same swim or current professionally necessarily as we were when we were in our 30s and 40s. And there is ageism in the workplace. And should you lose your job in your 50s or 60s, as you know, not because you lost your job, just because you know, it's much more difficult to get another job. And so if we're defining ourselves against the standard that we had when we were 40, we're going to come up short. So it also helps us to redefine the standard, how we're trying to evaluate ourselves to play to our strengths and who we are these days.
Makes sense. Another way of adapting.
Yeah. And I've seen people really struggle with this. And those who, I think, come to a greater acceptance of who they are, make that shift.
And that links back to some of your earlier comments about happiness.
Mm-hmm.
Later life and really linking with that. And you write in the book about identity, purpose, and goals. Any thoughts on how people could think about having goals at this stage?
I was having dinner with a friend last night. He's our age, 64, and he was saying he feels invisible and that he doesn't count anymore. I was really kind of shocked by this, and I was a little bit shocked that he was revealing this to me, because it's something I feel so strongly about, which is about the visibility of people who are over 50, because it is a challenge. Yeah, the culture, mainstream media, advertisements, we either start to disappear or the way that we appear is, playing to the stereotypes. So the first part of having goals is making sure that you are present, you feel visible to yourself, and that you feel visible and you are visible to others. And going back to my mom, this is a strength that I saw in her. She was always a very stylish and fashionable woman and drew attention to herself that way. And she maintained that really until the end. She didn't have, she did have many other deficits, so to speak, but she was a striking woman and you could not overlook her. More specifically to setting goals, I think those kind of go into, how do I want to be remembered? I had a friend who turned 75 last week, and she was using a phrase that I had not heard, Joe, and maybe you're familiar with it. But it was RT, remaining time. Have you heard that?
No, that's an interesting one.
Yeah, and it seemed like slang for, the septuagenarians. But she was very, aware of, I'm 75, how do I want to spend this remaining time? And what was nice at her birthday party, I'm going to give her a call out here, Pat Revels, happy birthday. A friend of hers who's 95 gave a little speech and said, here I am 20 years older than you. And here's how I use that remaining time. And I hope I still have some more remaining time.
And that's a great question. How do you want to use the remaining time?
When, of course, we don't know whether that's really a week, 10 years, or whatever that is. So that really compels us to be in the moment every day. And I'll share something personal here. And my sister has ovarian cancer, and she's been open about that, so I'm not violating her privacy. But that has really forced all of us in our family and her friends to think, how do I want to live today? How do I want to be? It's a little emotional for me, but yeah, I think you get the point.
I appreciate you sharing it. And it really does that shift from one of my recent podcast guests, Connie Zweig, talked about the shift from less doing to more being.
You know, that's fascinating. I went on a meditation retreat right before the pandemic, and I was not a meditator except for 20 minutes here and there. And we were now doing 12 hours of meditation a day. And we could not read, could not look each other in the eye. We could not talk, write. And I was like, well, I said to the instructor, I didn't say to the instructor, I wrote to the instructor, we were allowed to ask those questions. Well, I don't know what to do then when I'm not meditating. And she said, you're sure? You have to be. And I'm like, I don't know what that means. And that was a lesson that came out of that 10 days. By not doing, in a way, I was forced to be. And that shift did happen. But I will say, it was very challenging. I kind of went through this horrible withdrawal, as though like I was quitting smoking or caffeine. And then did come to a different place, and a different place that helped me quite a bit during the pandemic, because I had to do a lot more being than doing. But the person who said that is absolutely right.
And not to get off topic, but any comments about the current level of civility and hope for our future as a society?
I'm going to bring that on topic. One of the great joys of being a writer is talking about your book and your ideas. And so I've had the opportunity to do that this summer, often in real time with people. And what I saw was that people were using this book to talk about the hard issues that I talked about at the beginning. And mothers were doing this with daughters, and fathers with daughters and sons. And it was a way to bridge a divide, to bridge fears. And I listened to them describe this to me, because I hadn't really seen this when I was writing the book or thought this would be an intended consequence. And what I heard from everyone who said that was, as part of that process, yes, they were listening to the other person, but they became vulnerable in that conversation. And so I look around, you know, the polarization in our communities over, you know, whatever the topic is, whether it's being vaxxed or not, masked or not, red or blue or purple, we're very reticent to be vulnerable in the conversations we have. And for some good reason. But I think that if we can open ourselves up and be the human who we are, the fearful person and the vulnerable person that we are, those are ways that humans can connect and get beyond many of these divisive things and find that that is where the human condition brings us together. So it's kind of actually sort of spurred me to think, well, how do I take some of the ideas from this book? And so I'm going to write about civility next time. And this notion of becoming vulnerable is a core part of that.
Such a great point. So, Stephen, I hope when people read your book that they read the afterword. For me, I found that there was such a lot of wisdom in there. What are the main messages you want people to take away when they read your book?
It's interesting, Joe. So I ended the book with the original last chapter, and then that felt very incomplete to me and also didn't allow for me to talk about how I had changed during the writing of this book, during the 2-3 years after my parents died. They both died in the winter of 2017. And so I came to a much greater place of acceptance and love for them and for the choices that they made. So, you know, I started off with, you know, these are the stupid things that I won't do. And I also hope that I will try to do as much as they did try to do. And I understood better, you know, the fears they had, and what it felt like for your life to become smaller as a result of, especially as a result of illnesses and medical conditions, how painful that was. And at the same time, still how important it was to stay connected, especially to people who love you and whom you love. And so that last part is really about acceptance. And I think also joining people in the conversation where they are and not trying to bring them where you are. And one example that comes to mind is my mom had terminal lung cancer. And twice in the months before she died, she said to me, she asked me, what is it going to be like for me to die? And twice, so, you know, here I grew up in New York City, I can be a little flip and so on. I just said, hey, mom, what do you want for dinner tonight? You and I talked about pivoting before we started the conversation. I did a total pivot because I couldn't have that conversation. I wasn't prepared. By the third time she asked me that, I realized I need to come join her in that conversation. It's uncomfortable, but she's asked me three times. I cannot ask her what she wants for dinner tonight. And so and we started to talk about it. And then the real question was, will it be painful? I said, no, mom, it won't be painful. You know, we'll be giving you whatever medications you need when that time comes, and we will be with you. I was so glad that she compelled me to join her. And I was frankly somewhat ashamed that I wasn't able to do it earlier, but I need to let go of that as well, because that takes me nowhere at this point.
That's such a powerful lesson about meeting people where they are.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Just so many different ways I can see applying that.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for sharing that. Stephen, thank you so much for taking the time to share your thoughts with us, and really enjoyed your book and enjoyed this conversation.
Well, Joe, thank you very much. I really appreciate the time with you.
Thanks again, Stephen.
Sure.
Appreciate Stephen Petro taking time to share his insights with us today. I found it to be a great conversation, and his book really makes you think. It's very funny at first, but as you get into it, start to recognize a lot of things that he's observed, and the realization that his book's really about making smarter choices. And if you're like me, you'll recognize some things that you actually not only observe in others, but recognize in yourself, things that you're already doing. And my first takeaway is flipping the script when I recognize those, asking the question, what am I going to do instead of that? What's the smarter choice here? My second takeaway is remaining time. That was a great concept and a great question for all of us. What are the key things you want to do in your remaining time? What's your list? Not necessarily a bucket list, but what are the most meaningful things on your list? How do you really want to invest that precious resource of time? And third, reflecting on his interactions with his parents, I'm asking myself the question, what can I learn from others? In particular, our four children who I've already learned a lot from, how can I learn more from them? How can I get another perspective on what I'm doing through their eyes? It may help me make smarter choices going forward. Those are my three takeaways. What are yours? Thank you for listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. Check out our website at retirementwisdom.com. You can find a lot of resources there, all 112 episodes of our podcast to browse by season. We're in our fourth season. And also free tools, retirement calculators, access to a longevity calculator. And you can schedule a call if you're interested in talking about our coaching, in particular, Design Your Life offering, where we help people create your new future in your next life.
Thank you for joining us today on the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. You can listen to all episodes of our podcast by subscribing to them on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher, or on our website at retirementwisdom.com.